Music to borrow money by.
All the moon belongs to everyone. The best things in life, they're free.
Hey, money is free, or nearly, after yesterday's Federal Reserve decision to drop a key interest rate to between 0 and 0.25%. 0% financing is no longer a gimmick.
The best things in life are free.
It's the policy of the U.S. government, and if this doesn't work, sub-zero economics on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Wednesday, December 17th. And John, where do I sign up for that free money?
Hey, anywhere. If you're a bank, you can get it, actually.
I'm not a bank, though. So I don't know. Anyhow, we're going to take a look at the Fed interest rate cut and expected OPEC oil production cuts. Also, we talked to one victim of the largest alleged scam in Wall Street's history. And a look at how Illinois Republicans think perhaps there may be a silver lining in the scandal surrounding Governor Rod Blagojevich. Those stories are coming up. First, these headlines.
After days of silence, the Securities and Exchange Commission Chair Chris Koch says his agency failed to properly investigate the financial Ponzi scheme allegedly run by Bernard Madoff, even after repeated warnings as far back as 1999. In a statement yesterday, Koch says a full investigation is now underway. Markets in Europe and Asia were mixed this morning as investors reacted to the Fed's interest rate cut. It's at a record low, between 0 and 0.25%. President-elect Barack Obama.
Although the Fed is still going to have more tools available to it, it is critical that the other branches of government step up. And that's why the economic recovery plan is so absolutely critical.
The Fed's move mid-afternoon yesterday spurred a big rally on Wall Street, but that was yesterday. The Dow closed up over 4%. Today, the futures are trading down.
The rate cut has direct implication for consumers as well. Most commercial banks have cut the rate they charge their best customers by 0.75%. Mortgage and credit card rates are expected to tumble also. It looks like there's a silver lining to the Blagojevich corruption scandal, at least for Illinois Republicans. Here's an excerpt from a TV commercial they're running.
Rod Blagojevich embarrassed Illinois. He tried to sell our Senate seat. And now Blagojevich's Lieutenant Governor Pat Quinn wants to hand-pick our senator, going back on his word.
That's an ad. It's part of an ad campaign to call for a special election to fill President-elect Barack Obama's vacant Senate seat. State Democrats say a special election would cost too much, but Republicans say the Democrats are just worried they'd lose the seat.
A new member of the transition team, Tom Vilsack, will serve as Secretary of Agriculture. The announcement is expected from Barack Obama later today. A new economic indicator will come out this hour. We'll learn the U.S. Current account trade deficit from last quarter. It tracks trends in foreign trade. Oil prices are above $45 a barrel this morning in Asian trading as we await OPEC's announcement of what's expected to be a record cut. And, you know, that was a prediction. Today we are talking about predictions.
We're looking at the remainder of the year as being probably positive growth, but not certainly not robust growth.
Wrong. That was Ben Bernanke in July, who had no crystal ball. Where did your crystal ball fail you? 877-8-MY-TAKE or MyTake at thetakeaway.org. The prediction game on The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. You know, in this record year of reversals and twists and turns in the economy and politically, most people's predictions sort of play like a blooper reel, if you think about it. What predictions do you have for 2008 that you got right or wrong? Okay, a lot of people predicted Barack Obama would be president, but take that one out and what you got? Lots of very, very bizarre predictions or things that seemed reasonable that just didn't come true. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE with your predictions, mytake at thetakeaway.org. Things you got right or wrong for 2008. Oil prices have climbed above 40 $45 a barrel today as investors wait to see how big a production cut OPEC will announce at a meeting in Algeria. Who would have expected $45 a barrel oil today, even as recently as July when it was at $140 a barrel? Oil ministers in OPEC say they will likely approve a cut of 2 million barrels a day from their output early next year, and that would be the single largest reduction ever by OPEC. Yesterday, we had the biggest drop in the consumer price index in that measure's history, and a historic cut in interest rates by the Fed, as we noted at the top of the hour. Money is basically free. Actually, it's less than free if you take inflation into account. The record year of 2008 is almost gone, and we're into scores and scores of economic records. Here to talk about everything that's going on this week is our friend Javier Blas, commodities correspondent for the Financial Times. Javier, thanks for joining us.
Hi, good morning.
Are you in London this morning?
Yeah, I'm in London.
That's right. And we're welcoming Javier back to the program, of course. And Kelly Evans is here in the studio. She's economics reporter for The Wall Street Journal. And it's great to have you here, Kelly.
Thanks for having me.
All these records. Javier, let's talk about oil, first of all. It seems to me that this is a real showdown for OPEC. I mean, if it's a cartel at all, it ought to be able to enforce a bottom in the oil price. But no matter what it does today, it's not clear if they can do that, right?
Well, they are working hard, and they are talking about cutting production by 2 million barrels a day. That's a record for OPEC. They have never cut as much as 2 million in a single cut. And that will be on top of already another 2 million that they have promised to reduce from the market in the last 3 months. So they are working very hard, but so far the consumption is slowing even faster than OPEC is able to cut his production.
And Javier, I know you love to watch the shipping channels in the world as an indicator of what's going on with oil prices. And I saw an indicator yesterday, actually in your paper, that there is more oil just sitting in supertankers than they've almost ever seen before. What does that mean?
Well, that means that tanks inland are already full, and companies are moving to supertankers, to floating storage, to keep the oil. That's the most, to me, you have to look for two signals to see that demand is just vanishing. One is the oil price is tanking, and the other one is when you begin to see oil companies using super tankers as a temporal way of storing oil because no one wants to buy it.
It's storage. Storage. They're storing it in boats. That's incredible. Nobody wants to buy this stuff. Kelly Evans here in the studio. What do you make of the CPI drop yesterday? Is that like great news for all of us right around the holidays, or just more sign of a recession?
Well, I think if you look at it in terms of reversing the huge price increases we had over the summer, then certainly households will say, yeah, I don't mind if things are a little bit cheaper right now. And a big part of this still is falling energy and
right.
petroleum prices.
But it's the biggest part.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's definitely driving the declines right now. But interestingly, even excluding energy and food items, which are a little more volatile, prices were flat. So it sort of suggests that we're really quickly getting this sort of fallout of the price increases, across the board. And, you know, again, while it may feel like better news certainly than huge price increases, it does kind of raise a lot of concerns, especially paired with the Fed's big decision yesterday to target 0% interest rates. It does raise concerns about deflation.
What's it like around there in the newsroom of the Wall Street Journal? With everybody, I mean, with all these records and these predictions that have been just dashed, I mean, you must be really scratching your head around there.
Yeah, I mean, it's been really interesting because if you look, you know, a year ago in sort of the fall of 2007, the stock market was hitting record highs, and in all of our warnings or sort of just as the economic data came in and we said, you know, geez, it's starting to look recessionary, it was kind of like, oh, well, you know, that's just crazy.
And then you open up your Rolodex, call somebody at Bear Stearns or Lehman Brothers, and hey, they can help you out with that. Can't do that anymore.
Well, we've had a steady ratcheting down of expectations across the board from all economists. I mean, it's gone from saying, oh, the worst of this will be in the first half of 2008, then we'll recover. And now all of a sudden it's 2009, 2010 that they're seriously talking about.
Wow.
And you talk about volatility, and Javier, it just begs the question of, I mean, OPEC really finds themselves in a pickle, don't they? Because they don't want to cut production to the point where there is an enormous jump in price and then depress demand further.
Yeah, it's a very difficult point at this meeting for OPEC. As you say, on one hand, they want higher prices because at $45 that we are right now, some of the OPEC countries, particularly Iran and Venezuela, but even Saudi Arabia, they will have problems financing their economies. On the other hand, they don't want to be seen as another obstacle on the recovery of the economy. And they really, their concern is that they are overdoing the cuts, and then they could put oil prices a lot higher and creating pain for consumers. But talking about predictions, one thing that is concerning OPEC quite a lot is the predictions from Wall Street banks that oil prices could drop as low as $25 to $30, and they want to avoid that.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think they'd be happy with just a bottom here, let alone a spike. A spike would be way too much to even hope for at this point. Is there any evidence that Russia is going to join the OPEC hot tub here in enforcing a production cut along with the traditional OPEC nations?
Well, we are going to have a lot of talk about Russia cutting his production, and obviously a huge delegation from Russia is at this OPEC meeting. But I think that's a lot of talk rather than action. Russia oil production, whatever they decide, is going to drop next year because of lack of investment. The companies in Russia are not investing enough to keep production not even just flat, but just to avoid a drop. Mm. So now the government is trying to do kind of a window dressing and say, you know, what we are indeed doing is cutting our production to help our OPEC guys. In a sense, it's like, well, this morning saying, well, the sun is going to rise. That's a good prediction because you know it's going to happen.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I'm solidly with that prediction, Javier.
Russia is doing basically the same. They know that their oil production is going to drop in 2009, whatever they do. So they are trying to put the best spin on that drop. And now they pretend to say, well, you know what? We are going to help and join OPEC. Well, you know, they are saying so, but no one in the market is believing it.
Thanks, Javier.
Kelly, just in terms of all these numbers and the volatility in the oil industry, as a consumer, what numbers should we be paying attention to and be most concerned about or perhaps most encouraged about?
You mean in terms of oil prices or
oil prices or any of these numbers that we're talking about?
Well, one interesting thing about oil prices, obviously, it's done a lot to sort of boost household wealth and really take pressure off budgets and off balance sheets. And again, it's sort of like while that's encouraging, it's happening for the wrong reasons. It's happening because of this economic slowdown. So the curious thing I think about a lot of the data right now is that while on the one hand it seems to indicate, you know, again, a little more breathing room for consumers, it just really reflects people being so hard-pressed. I mean, you talk to anyone, and it's sort of like, you know, isn't it great that gas is cheaper? And they're like, well, yeah, but I'm out of a job, you know, or yeah, but, you know, my 401k has lost 40%. So it's hard, I think, in this situation to really take any one number out of context. I mean, it really is just trying to talk about how best to take this pressure off of families.
Well, let's look at one number, and I'd love to know what the Wall Street Journal is thinking. I mean, unemployment may stabilize this month, but there's an expectation, and I've seen it in a number of places, that in January and February, unemployment is going to steeply accelerate. Do you go along with that prediction? Do you think that's safe at this point, or might we get a reprieve?
Well, the one interesting thing about unemployment rate this year is that even as it sort of started jumping quickly earlier this year, people kept saying, oh, well, next month it'll probably stabilize, and then it would sort of defy expectations and continue rising again. So, but yeah, because of seasonal reasons and things like that, it probably won't be as volatile in December, I would think. And again, a lot of economists and people are looking to see what happens with this holiday season. What are sales actually going to come in like? Are retailers going to have to institute another round of layoffs? Or companies
or
more
bankruptcy.
Broadly.
Just bankruptcy.
Exactly.
Right.
I mean, we've already seen it with some major chains. It's really not out of the question because so much of their annual revenues rely on holiday sales. So that's the big question. What does it mean for going into 2009?
Javier, I'm going to give you one chance. So you want to predict what this OPEC production cut is going to do to prices, up or down?
They're going to go up.
It's going to break 50?
I think we are going to break 50 by the end of the year. Yes, I do think that OPEC is going to put a floor. I don't think that they are going to be able to raise the price a lot more, but at least they are going to be able to stabilize the price at $50. Please don't call me tell me
no,
that
sorry,
I'm wrong.
Sorry, Javier. That is a reason to have you back on the program. Absolutely. Javier Blas is a commodities correspondent for the Financial Times. Thanks for joining us, as always.
Thank you.
And Kelly Evans, don't go anywhere. She's an economics reporter for the Wall Street Journal. She's staying with us.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age? Everybody has their own opinion. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. Kelly Evans, an economic reporter for The Wall Street Journal, is still with us. And we're going to turn our attention now to Christopher Cox, the Securities and Exchange Commission chairman, who is now blaming his career regulators for a decade-long failure to investigate money manager Bernard Madoff, accused of running one of the largest Ponzi schemes ever seen on Wall Street. Cox has now ordered an internal investigation as to what went wrong. This week, hundreds of investors are reeling from the arrest of Madoff, and for some, it means closing their doors. That would include the JET Foundation, Justice, Equality, Human Dignity, and Tolerance Foundation. That's what that stands for. In 2006 alone, it gave away over $26 million to social justice causes. We welcome its president and CEO, Robert Crane. Welcome and good morning, Robert.
Thank you for having me.
How are you coping?
Well, you know, we're trying to close ourselves down in an orderly way and in a way that is respectful of the people we've supported over the years. And so at the moment, we have so much to do that we're really just moving forward with the tasks of the day. And it's a tragedy, obviously, for our staff, but even more so for all the people we supported. So our first goal is to really try to make people's situation as good as we can in these last days of our institution.
So would it be shock? 1 minute you're in business, you're planning for 2009, and the next minute you get a phone call. What happened?
I was in my office at 6 o'clock on last Thursday night when the donors to the foundation called me and said, sit down, we have something terrible to tell you. And of course, we chatted about it and immediately just sprung into action because we knew that our first responsibility was to do the best we could. I mean, it's surreal, I think, is the best word to call what happened, because neither they nor I had any expectation of this. Our expectation was that the foundation was actually going to grow in the next several years.
And Robert, I'm just doing the math here. If you gave $26 million away last year, and I presume that wasn't endowment, that was interest— I mean, the amount of money that vanished seems to be rather sizable here.
I'm sure it was. I mean, I'm not directly involved with the donors' finances, so I don't really have those numbers, but it's quite sizable. And, of course, much of their wealth was used to support this philanthropic organization. These are people who I think very personally are deeply, deeply affected by this, not so much because they lost their money, frankly, but because they lost their calling.
And the calling here for the 24 employees that you now have to let go is this foundation is one of the rare foundations that specifically focused on social justice issues. Do you want to tell us about some of the recipients and some of the programs that you have given money to?
And I'm happy to do that. And I think let me say first that not only did we focus on social justice issues, but we focused on some of the harder-to-fund social justice issues and harder-to-fund segments of the American population that need support. And so I think the loss of this foundation is doubly difficult because there aren't many funders, for example, who support criminal justice reform work in this country or juvenile justice reform work in this country or international justice work, which we also do, or frankly, election reform work that we also do.
Well, let's talk about the juvenile justice work. I mean, is that funding paralegals and advocates for people in juvenile courts, or are we talking more about analysis and academic studying of the system?
It's a range of things. I mean, we actually work across the board. We're a foundation that's focused largely on policy reform, and so we actually work with advocates, we work with government, we work with academics when there's needed research that needs to be done. And so I think every facet of it gets affected by our funding.
So just quickly, you're talking about organizations like the Innocence Project, yes. Human Rights Watch. You've also funded some state efforts to deal with teenage recidivism rates.
Right.
It's a very wide swath of organizations that you were giving money to.
Now, we're the largest funder in the country of criminal justice reform work. So while we're not the largest funder in the country by any means in general, there are much bigger foundations than the Jet Foundation. In the areas we fund, we are among the one, two, or three largest funders in all of the areas we fund.
As of last Thursday, anyway.
And, as of last Thursday, correct.
And Kelly Evans, the economics reporter from Wall Street Journal, let me bring you into this conversation. Given the uncertainty and the jitters already on the market, the Madoff announcement and arrest really sends a chilling message, not only for individual investors, corporate investors, and charitable investors, right? I mean, what was the sense when this unfolded?
Yeah, I mean, in what has been sort of a frustration for the Federal Reserve and in all of its efforts is basically not just to flood the system with money, but to get banks to lend to one another. I mean, and to get investors to do the same, and even to have with people to have confidence in the market. So when you have a blow like this, such a massive loss of wealth, I mean, what does that do? It doesn't matter if interest rates are zero. You know, who's going to trust that other party? So it raises issues there. And then even as I'm listening to the descriptions of the fallout out here from just this charity, and it's, you know, I think about all the people unemployed, all that loss of money and the ripple effect throughout the economy, and it's just kind of like you add that together and in terms of all the parties affected by this, and it, I don't know, it's just devastating.
Well, you can't put a price on that confidence, and just like you can't put a price on the good works of your foundation.
Right. Robert Crane, President and CEO of the Jet Foundation, we wish you all the best, and we thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And Kelly Evans, an economic reporter for The Wall Street Journal, thank you. We turn now to Femi Okeh, who's got headlines for us.
Hello there. It is 27 minutes past the hour. Global markets are mixed after the Fed slashed its key interest rate to historic lows. Asian stocks climbed modestly, but European shares have fallen. Investor enthusiasm was tempered by a mix of lingering worries about the U.S. economy and a weakening dollar. Also weighing on markets was a steep drop in U.S. stock futures. Oil prices rose on anticipation of an OPEC production cut. Morgan Stanley is reporting a quarterly loss of $2.3 billion, much worse than expected. And a quick reminder of this event.
So what if the guy threw a shoe at me?
That was President Bush talking about the flying shoe incident on Sunday in Baghdad. And that size 10 pair of shoes have apparently had an impact on the Speaker of Iraq's parliament. The Associated Press is reporting that he is resigning after legislators argue about the shoe-throwing case. The Iraqi journalist who threw his shoes at President Bush appeared before a judge Wednesday, but from his jail cell. Now, his brother said that it's a sign that the reporter was too badly injured to appear in a courtroom. And the lawyer for Illinois Governor Rod Blagojevich is planning to attend today's meeting of a special House committee reviewing possible impeachment. Ed Jensen's appearance could provide the first hint of the Democratic governor's strategy as he faces corruption charges.
Thanks, Femi.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org and by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world. Uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering home insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. Man, 2008, it's safe to say, has been a tough year for predictions.
Hi, this is Doug from Kenton Falls, New Jersey. I predicted that Barack Obama would win the election based solely on his voice. The fact that his voice was the most pleasant to listen to on the radio and in TV news soundbites. That was my prediction.
Well, somebody got something right.
That.
Somebody got something right. If you predicted something correctly for 2008 or something outrageous that didn't transpire, as it turned out, or there are a few more days left, it still could happen. 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. But who would have predicted that this would be part of the Bush legacy?
So what if the guy threw a shoe at me?
That's right. The Iraqi journalist Muntadir al-Zaidi, he's been in custody since Sunday when he threw both of his shoes at President Bush during a news conference. The event has turned him into a folk hero throughout the world and especially in the Arab world. And who knew the name of Muntadir al-Zaidi until, you know, last weekend? Mark Barkowski is a British publicist and the author of The Fame Formula, which is about how people can go from nothingness to global fame. He joins us now from London. Mark, thanks for being part of the program.
You're most welcome. Hello.
Now, you know, poor Muntadir al-Zaidi, he's in jail. He can't really take advantage of all the stuff that's happened in his absence. People are, like, carrying his picture around. They're, trading YouTube videos. They've made video games about throwing shoes at President Bush's head. You know, he's not making any money off of this. What would you advise him?
Well, undoubtedly he'll get out. I mean, he's becoming a cult folk hero. And with all his publicity he is generating and with the one world brand equity he's got at the moment, when he comes out, he needs to be nourished by somebody and taken on and actually exploit this sort of fame. He's gone from fabulous nobody to fabulous somebody. And with a great agent and with some great help, there's an untold amount of activities that he could be doing to be plundering in terms of sort of product launches, personality appearances. And you bet your bottom dollar that Hollywood will be looking at producing a movie about this guy's life.
All right, well, let's talk a little strategy here, Mark. I mean, should he stick with the name al-Zaidi or should he go Shoe Guy?
He's absolutely going to go become Shoe Guy. I don't think those sort of names go down well in middle America somehow. But, he is what he is, shoe-throwing man, and that's what he needs to – that's his brand. And I think there's an internet place for him to be sent all over the world to throw shoes at people that we don't like. He could become the polarity for what we, in terms of some sense of protest. But, you know, clearly his name has got to be right, and the first outings for him and what he does around the globe is going to be crucial.
All right, Mark, is there any knowledge of what brand of shoes he threw and, you know, what could be done with that?
Well, I think that's the best part of it. We don't know what the shoe was, but there's plenty of other shoe brands, trainers out there, sports footwear, football boots, soccer boots. You know, they're spending a lot of money of putting those boots around major global personalities. Stand aside David Beckham, there's a new person who could be wearing the boot and throwing the boot at the same time. So it's good that we don't know what the boot is because it gives it wide open for shoe manufacturers all over the globe to sort of support this guy.
I see. So you could actually develop shoes where the idea is comfortable and a great throwing shoe as well.
Oh, absolutely. I think that you could throw them on sort of telegraph wires as an example. They could just hanging there. It was a big sport in the UK of throwing old trainers. They sort of dangled from the street from these overhead wires. It's very cheap to manufacture these things, and so therefore it's very quick to produce the bootman's boot.
Mark, let's talk globally here. I mean, it seems like most of the ideas you've suggested are appropriate for sort of the UK Hollywood nexus of fame. But what about exploiting the sort of Eastern, you know, Arab world? And, I mean, should he go on? Should he get his own show on Al Jazeera, for instance?
100%. Al Jazeera should be booking him as soon as he gets out of the slammer. He's got a cult status because he expresses something from the Arab world, particularly from the youthful Arab world, about protest. And we do like renegades. We do like mavericks. We like people who stand up and say something. And I think global youth, be they Arab or Western, totally relate to his expressions. And I think most brands want to sort of track into that youthful market. And across the Middle East, he could be a cult hero.
Now, where could he go wrong, Mark? What does he need to really worry about? He's a Shiite, and of course, there's the Shiite shoe thing. You don't want to get religion too much involved in this sort of thing, but there's a kind of a, you know, irresistible sort of alliteration there.
It is. I mean, one has to be respectful for, you know, some of the religious views, and we've seen many people come unstuck from that. And that's why I think that perhaps he should be heading towards, you know, the West with the right sort of backing. And he must be very careful about how he's received, you know, in his, you know, in his own homeland. He doesn't want to sort of aggravate or necessarily upset people where, when this 15 months of fame, and my book sort of deals with that formally, we've got 15 months to exploit this, and that after that, you don't want to go back and find you can't carry on with your other life.
Right, right. Well, Mark, would you represent him quickly before we go?
I'd fly out to where he is now to take him on. He's just got so much potential, even in recessionary times.
Well, at the very least, I mean, if they don't, treat him well in prison, there are people on the waiting on the outside to treat him very well. The saga of Muntadir al-Zaidi, as told through Mark Barkowski, who's a British publicist and the author of The Fame Formula, which is all about going from zero to globally famous in 1 second. Thanks for joining us, Mark.
You're welcome.
And now headlines from Femi Okeh.
Thank you very much. It's coming up to 21 minutes to the top of the hour. The U.S. current account deficit narrowed to just over $174 billion in the third quarter, a better improvement than the $179 billion expected by economists. Democratic sources say that President-elect Barack Obama has picked former Iowa Governor Tom Vilsack to become his agriculture secretary. Vilsack ran for president earlier this year, and he'll be the fourth former rival to join Team Obama. California Representative Javier Becerra says that he's decided not to accept Obama's offer to become the U.S. Trade Representative. Becerra says that he thinks trade isn't a high enough priority for the incoming administration and that he can do more in the House. SEC Chairman Christopher Cox says his agency failed to follow through properly on allegations against Bernard Madoff, the man at the center of an alleged $50 billion scam. Cox says that he's gravely concerned about the failures and has ordered an investigation. The Fed's decision to cut interest rates to their lowest level on record is good news for banks and consumers. The cut is expected to lead to lower rates on existing adjustable rate home equity loans, and a new boom in refinancing is expected. And President Bush is expected to trumpet his war record when he speaks today at the U.S. Army War College in Pennsylvania. Let's look at some news making the headlines this morning.
Thank you, Femi.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
Good morning. This is The Takeaway. I'm Adora Udoji.
And I'm John Hockenberry. And, you know, it takes a brave soul, just in general terms, to be a predictor about anything. But for 2008, you got to be beyond brave, because of the twists and turns of this year. But nobody really expected this year to be such
exactly.
a twister and a turner. So we've got, on the record, a lot of really fabulous predictions that, are questionable at best.
In hindsight,
Got to feel sorry for economists because they, you know, that's their game, predicting all the time.
And they weren't really accurate this year.
Do you recognize this guy's voice?
We should not expect to work through this process quickly. And we should expect some bumps on the road. But in my judgment, we are closer to the end of the market turmoil than the beginning.
That's Hank Paulson speaking back in May, closer to the end than the beginning. I wonder what he would say now.
Today.
But we're asking you at 877-8-MY-TAKE to be a part of our predictions, kind of hindsight rethink Monday morning quarterback about 2008, or to give your predictions about the future at mytake@thetakeaway.org, like our friend Troy did.
Good morning. This is Troy calling from North Dakota, and one conversational prediction I can readily admit to completely missing the boat on is, of course, the bailout funds will be heavily regulated. They won't just give the banks the money with no strings. Unbelievable, huh?
It's so easy to throw bricks at glass houses, of course, but then I think the mother of all predictions were related to the election.
False prediction. Whom will McCain pick as his running mate?
Mitt Romney.
Minnesota Governor Tim Pawlenty.
Charlie Crist, Florida Governor.
Condoleezza Rice.
Buchanan and Wright, it will be Mitt Romney. Happy Mother's Day. Bye-bye.
Not a single right answer in that bunch.
Actually, if you go to YouTube and put in predictions, that comes up at the top.
Why do you think that is? It's so interesting. But here's another prediction,
so
because they weren't the only ones making wrong predictions about the election cycle this year either.
My friends, we're going to carry Ohio and we're going to win the presidency, and we need you out there working every single moment for the next 5 days.
Well, poor McCain. I mean, I guess in truth he was wrong about absolutely everything. But here's a more sophisticated prediction.
My name is Jimmy. I'm calling from New York. 5 years ago, I could never have imagined that we would have switched to digital media. It's happened. 35mm film is almost completely a thing of the past. Working 3 to 4 days a week on film shoots in New York City, I only see film maybe once or twice a month.
Whoa, wow. Film, it's gone. What about oil prices? There's a prediction that really takes a brave soul.
Stumped many
How
people.
How bad will it get? Well, some analysts now predict that oil prices could reach $200 a barrel over the next 6 months to 2 years.
$200 a barrel over the next 6 or 2 years. It's like $43 a barrel today?
Which is exactly the same number of seconds we have left in this segment. Here's another prediction.
A year ago, prices were trading at $2.32 a gallon. Now you're going to pay $3.05. And John Kilduff, who I know you speak with often as well, Brian, he says we could see prices at the pump as high as $4 a gallon.
And, President Bush, we got to get him into this game, right?
I think we can actually get an agreement on global climate change during my presidency. Just so you know.
There's still time, President Bush. There's still time. Anyway, give us your predictions at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org.
Just so you know.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to, available at responsibilityproject.com. Because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. It's Wednesday, December 17th, and Femi Okeh has just joined us, and she's got headlines.
Good morning. The time is 13 minutes to the top of the hour. A new economic indicator is just out. The U.S. current account deficit narrowed to just about $174 billion in the third quarter, a better improvement than the $179 billion expected by economists. So far, markets in Asia and Europe have been mixed this morning as investors react to the Fed's interest rate cut. It's at a record low between 0.25%. Prime Minister Gordon Brown says that British troops will be fully out of Iraq by July the 31st, 2009. Brown made the announcement today during a news conference with the Iraqi Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki in Baghdad. He says that he plans to provide details to the British Parliament about troop withdrawal tomorrow. It's the third day of a bitter cold snap across much of the nation, and the weather has been blamed for at least 20 deaths. That's including 11 in traffic accidents. Hundreds of flights have been cancelled in Chicago airports. Skiers at the world-famous Whistler Resort in British Columbia are counting their blessings today. A tower supporting a ski lift crumpled, and more than 50 people had to be evacuated from 30 gondolas. Eyewitness Jordan McDonald talked to the Canadian Press about the accident.
It was like a big creaking and then a crash. Like, it was pretty loud. People were screaming everywhere. It was pretty traumatic.
Police say that there were no serious injuries, and the Whistler Ski Resort is now investigating to find out why the ski lift tower collapsed. And Ohio's Cleveland Clinic has completed the nation's first face transplant. Surgeons replaced 80% of a woman's face with that of a female cadaver, and the patient's name and age have not been released, but there will be a press conference at 1 o'clock Eastern time today. First time in the US, it's happened twice in France and once in China before. And that's a look at stories making news this morning.
Thanks, Femi.
So Dorothy famously said, we're not in Kansas anymore when she landed in the land of Oz, but she might have been speaking of the state of Illinois.
Let us remember that we are not Alice in Wonderland. We're not the Red Queen. We do not sentence first and then do the verdict. Illinois frontier days are long in the past. Frontier justice will not prevail in this proceeding. A rush to judgment does not serve the people of the state well.
Alice in Wonderland or Wizard of Oz, whatever your metaphor, that's Illinois State Representative Barbara Flynn Curry describing the stalemate situation that now is taking hold in the state of Illinois as the legislators attempt to debate what to do about Governor Blagojevich, who shows no signs of considering resignation. He's hired an attorney. It's not even clear if he can be impeached. The special election that was the idea last week as to how to deal with this is suddenly on hold. Joining us to explain all of this is Amanda Vinicky, who's a State House reporter for Illinois Public Radio. And, you know, as a prediction of what could have happened in Illinois state government, this has to be one for the books, Amanda.
You know, I do think that it was widely predicted that at some point Rod Blagojevich was going to get in some trouble with the feds, but all of what's come out, I think, is astonishing to everyone at this point.
The hiring of this attorney seems to be a line in the sand for the legislature in the sense that Blagojevich is signaling that he's not going anywhere anytime soon.
You know, Rod Blagojevich is known as a fighter. He's known for being very defiant. And I think that, yes, his not obviously he needs an attorney to fight the criminal charges that he will be facing. But in terms of bringing in this high-profile attorney to the impeachment hearings, I do think that that could be a sign he's going to fight them and that this is going to be one very long, drawn-out process when everybody just wishes that the governor would resign. You hear from all the legislators, please just go and make this all stop for the taxpayers, for us, for you. I do think that this is a sign that we're going to be seeing some cross-examinations, perhaps, and like I said, a drawn-out process before this committee concludes. And then there's a whole lot that has to go after even this committee makes a decision on impeachment.
Well, some tough language from Edward Jensen, who's the lawyer hired, a very well-known legendary attorney in Chicago, who said, we're not agreeing to impeachment. If you read these transcripts closely, referring to the Fitzgerald transcripts, you'll find that nobody did anything. People are just talking, and that's not against the law. He's daring the legislature and Patrick Fitzgerald to prove all this stuff.
You know, and I do think it's something when this affidavit came out, everybody was reading it, and it's 76 pages long, and it's got a lot of some bad language and the governor making deals, allegedly, and people were shocked. But it is a lot of talk, and there has been some criticism that Patrick Fitzgerald said that he hurried to bring these out and make them public before Rod Blagojevich could make an appointment in exchange for money, before he could do anything wrong. And yet, maybe some people are thinking, I've read reports from legal experts and analysts that say, you know, maybe this is going to put a clinch on all this because, again, it's talk, no action.
And so
that's
an enormous question. And obviously, he's hired a lawyer that's beyond competent to address some of those issues. But there are multiple charges, and for each one, there's some discussion as to how strong one is versus the other. But the bottom line is, politically, last week it sounds like everyone was stunned. This week it's like, oh, impeachment is a little bit more complicated. It's never happened in the state of Illinois where a governor has been impeached. It sounds like it's going to be far trickier than initially, at least politicians hoped. But secondarily, you have this Republican issue, right? Which is now they've launched a campaign lobbying for a special election. You want to tell us about that?
Sure. You know, Republicans in the state of Illinois have really been very down and out. Democrats control everything, which is why you see from the governor's office on down, all of the statewide constitutional officers, the House, the Senate. And so I think the Republicans are capitalizing on this opportunity to say, hey, we need to elect somebody from the GOP in Illinois, because look at what Democrats have done with the trust that you, the voters, have given them. And they're saying with this special election, especially, after these allegations first came out against the governor, there were widespread calls from Democrats, including President Obama and Senator Dick Durbin, saying we should hold a special election instead to fill Obama's now vacated seat. Democrats are backing off, and a lot of people say, you know, it sure as heck looks as if Democrats are afraid that they're going to lose that seat. So that's what Republicans are airing commercials. They're really trying to make big hay out of that.
Well, Amanda, here's Illinois Representative Sue Bassey, who is actually talking about the opportunity that this potentially represents, and it's kind of in dire terms. Here's Sue Bassey.
We are in a situation where we have a state that has been immobilized by the current situation brought about by the allegations against the governor. We have a state in crisis that cannot pay its bills, and if the governor would do the right thing and resign, then the action of this committee would be unnecessary.
Now, she sounds sort of downbeat there, but there's a certain smile behind the words, and I'm wondering if there are already consequences to the state of Illinois from everything that's gone on.
You know, I think that there are consequences just in the attention being drawn away from this, in the sense that a lot of people are saying that, you know, even if the governor is proven innocent of all of these charges, he clearly is having to fight them. And that means that he can't be dealing with the business of the state of Illinois and all of those kind of major budget issues and social issues that are in the state right now if he's fighting charges. And then also, I think you see a material consequence in that Illinois' bond rating has been dropped by Fitch. And that means that Illinois has had to go forward because of this budget issue that we're in. Illinois is very behind on paying its bills to doctors, healthcare, social service providers, and so took out a loan basically to help pay these bills more on time. And the state treasurer says that it's cost Illinois now $20 million is the cost of corruption, he is saying, in the sense that Because the bond rating dropped, we had to pay more for interest.
Bond rating drops, the delay, it all costs money. Amanda Vinicky, thanks so much for joining us. Amanda Vinicky is a State House reporter for Illinois Public Radio, and she joined us from Springfield.
Not going to be a quick, simple answer to those issues in Illinois. No. But here at The Takeaway, it is quick and simple. We're talking about predictions all day long. And listen to what this listener predicted.
Good morning. This is Mark calling from Massachusetts. And my prediction was that The Takeaway was going to be an utter disaster. I was actually upset because I thought they were taking away Morning Edition from me. I now find that I listen to The Takeaway religiously. As a matter of fact, I have a system set up to record it in case I don't quite catch the whole thing.
Well, thank you, Mark. We like his prediction.
We'll hold you to that one. And here's your takeaway.
Stand aside, David Beckham. There's a new person who could be wearing the boot and throwing the boot at the same time.
That's Mark Borkowski, British publicist and the author of The Fame Formula, talking about the man who threw his shoes at President Bush. But on that fame segment, Emily was offended and said to look at this lightly through the lens of 15 minutes of fame is insulting to Iraqis and others who do not hold the administration's views of U.S. actions in Iraq. I'm John Hockenberry.
I'm Adora Udoji.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. The Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org. And by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway.
Okay, so let me get this straight. I got a gun and a cannoli. What do I do now?
Leave the gun. Take the cannoli.
The Italian government is taking no cannolis this morning. In the biggest roundup of alleged mafia bosses in years, 94 members of the Sicilian mob are in jail. The raid was to prevent the naming of a new board of directors. Headless in Palermo. Keep the cannoli. You're going to need them on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Wednesday, December 17th. Hey, John, you got any cannolis?
I'm keeping the cannolis. Good morning, Adora.
Today we take a look at the unprecedented transition of power from President Bush to President-elect Obama. More ripples from the largest alleged Ponzi scam in Wall Street's history, and the story about how the Italian government is trying to break the mafia. Those stories are coming up. First, these headlines.
With eyes wide shut, that's a description of how Securities and Exchange Commission Chair Chris Koch says his organization dealt with the billion-dollar Ponzi scheme allegedly run by Bernard Madoff. Koch says his agency failed to investigate numerous leads against Madoff, despite warning signs going back almost a decade. Koch says he's now directing a full investigation.
Just released this morning, the current account trade deficit for the U.S. The Commerce Department reports it fell by 3.7%. That's actually better than economists expected, but it's sort of a mixed signal. It's expected to continue to fall as the recession lowers demand for foreign goods. That's something else for investors to consider. In addition to yesterday's rate cut from the Fed, it's now at the historic low between 0.25%. Dow futures are currently down.
And while Wall Street does its usual bob and weave in reaction, the cut should have an immediate effect on Main Street, according to President-elect Barack Obama.
What the Fed does or what our administration does in terms of short-term emergency action is obviously going to be important to people's everyday lives.
The cut by the Federal Reserve is intended to free up billions of dollars in credit for mortgages, car loans, and credit cards. Most banks have already decreased their prime interest rate by 0.75%.
At least 18 people have been killed and dozens more wounded in a double bombing in eastern Baghdad. Iraqi police say the first blast came from a car bomb, then a roadside bomb exploded moments later as people rushed to help. Meanwhile, Britain has confirmed its troop will be out of Iraq, all of them, by the end of July 2009. Prime Minister Gordon Brown announced that in a surprise visit to Baghdad.
According to Democratic sources, former Iowa Governor Tom Vilsack will be the next Secretary of Agriculture, a strong advocate for developing ethanol as a way to reduce the nation's reliance on foreign oil. An official announcement is expected later today. Oil prices rose above $45 a barrel in Asian trading today after an expected production cut from OPEC about an hour from now, expected to be a record. And Wall Street futures suggest that the Dow Jones Industrial Average and the S&P 500 will begin trading lower this morning. So it's difficult to predict. I mean, I just made a prediction there. We've got Britain predicting it's going to remove its troops from Iraq by July of 2009. It's very difficult making predictions in this twisty, turny time of 2008. 877-8-MY-TAKE to register your predictions, right or wrong, about this year or the coming year. Also, you can reach us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning. In just over 1 month, Barack Obama will take over the White House. And right now, there is an unprecedented transition taking place, which Peter Baker from our partners, The New York Times, has been covering. He joins us now from Washington. Good morning and welcome back, Peter.
Good morning. How are you today?
Very well. And you?
Great. Couldn't be better.
Good. This is the first transition of presidential power since 9/11, and you talk about a dozen contingency plans that the Bush administration is passing on to the Obama people. You want to tell us about that?
Right. Well, this is, as you said, the first transition since 9/11. A lot of people have learned lessons from that, trying to find ways to make sure this handover of power doesn't open a window of vulnerability for the country. We've seen terrorists in the past take advantage of moments of flux in national leadership to launch attacks, both here in the United States in 1993 when they hit the World Trade Center very shortly, only a few weeks after President Clinton took office, and also more recently in places like Britain and Spain. So one of the things that Bush White House, the outgoing White House, is doing is creating a series of contingency plans or memos for the incoming president to say, look, if in your first hours or days in office, when you're still getting your feet planted and trying to figure out where the water cooler is, something really big happens, here are some ways of looking at it, and here are some potential options that would be available to you. Things like a North Korean nuclear test, or you know, a big outbreak of instability in the Middle East, or something like that.
How does the tone of a memo like that go? And you did say a moment ago that President Clinton took office before 9/11. You meant President Bush, I'm sure, right?
No. I meant in the first World Trade Center attack was 1993. People will forget that, but it happened, I think, in February of 1993, just weeks after President Clinton took office. Obviously, in President Bush's case, yes, 9/11 happened. It was 8 months after he took office. But even then, a lot of the key national security people hadn't been confirmed by the Senate yet, weren't yet in place, and that was something that prompted a lot of reform. And an intelligence law that was passed in 2004, it speeded up, hopefully, the process of getting people security clearances and hopefully getting people confirmed to the Senate so that we'll get the key appointees of President-elect Obama in place in a faster way than it did happen for President Bush. Well,
so what's the tone of a memo like this? In case of a nuclear explosion in North Korea, look in the third drawer from the left for, like, the briefing book? I mean, how does it work?
I mean, basically, yes. In effect, they're meant to be. I haven't seen them. I don't think they're going to show them to us. But they're meant to be informational. They're meant to say, look, you know, if this is to happen, here are the four or five or six things that you would have available to you as a president in your toolbox, in effect. And you know, look, it's not that the incoming Obama people don't know a lot of these things. Obviously, a lot of them are very seasoned and experienced at national security. General Jim Jones is going to be the national security advisor. He used to be the NATO commander. Defense Secretary Robert Gates is obviously staying on. But things have changed. A lot of the people who are coming in are Clinton administration veterans, and while they're smart about the world, you know, there wasn't a Department of Homeland Security the last time they were in government, so they don't, you know what I mean, they haven't been in the position of calling which office in this case, you know, as they might be this time. There wasn't a National Director of Intelligence the way there is today 8 years ago. So things have changed, and this is a way of trying to help the new team understand where all the buttons are.
You actually quote a White House spokesman who basically sums up the memos by saying, and they're not exhaustive, it's not exclusive, it's or prescriptive, it's just essentially some things for the Obama people to keep in mind. But another aspect of your report that's really interesting is that it goes beyond just memos, that there has been some training already.
That's right, exactly. Well, look, one of the things that happens in a new administration, of course, is we do wait for Senate confirmation for a lot of the people, not just cabinet people. Obviously, the Senate will work very hard to get the Secretary of State, Secretary of Homeland Security, and so forth installed right away when President-elect Obama takes office. But there's deputy secretaries and undersecretaries and assistant secretaries and so forth. And if those people aren't yet in place, they usually have career government officials filling in until they are. So what the administration has done is they've taken as many as 100 of these people who work in Homeland Security type positions and given them training and had tabletop exercises so that when they're filling in these first few days and maybe weeks of a new administration, they would be prepared to handle a big crisis that might come up.
And you talked about the Clinton White House, you brought that up, and there is yet another former member of the Clinton White House who is helping with this transition, Betty Curry. Remember her?
That's right, exactly. Betty Curry is back. It does show you the old gang really is getting back in town. She was, of course, President Clinton's personal secretary for 8 years in the White House. She got kind of caught up in that whole Monica Lewinsky investigation, much to her chagrin, I'm sure. She's back today working as a volunteer out of retirement for John Podesta, who's the co-chairman of President-elect Obama's transition team. She's answering phones in his office, helping him organize things. You know, John Podesta has known her for 30 years, says, who else would I call when I need to do something as big as this?
Obviously, the Clinton expertise is something that the Obama people would want to rely on in any transition. But I'm wondering, Peter, if you get the sense that for some of the Clinton folks who are part of this transition, that they're motivated to try and get it right this time because of precisely the scandal you referred to, the whole Lewinsky business, which tainted so many of their careers.
Yeah, I've heard some of them say, look, this time around, at least we don't have to worry about what's going on in the Oval Office when the door's closed. I mean, I think that they certainly are looking to see if they can take the experience they had and use it to better effect this time. And look, you know, the times under President Clinton were, largely peaceful. There was prosperity. But the challenges weren't as big as they are today. So I think some of the people who worked in that administration who are coming back now are saying, you know, I really want to take on the big challenges and see if we can do some big things.
And Peter, I want you to help me with something, because I continually read and hear this criticism that somehow the Clintonites are taking over the White House. But how in the world would Barack Obama go into Washington, D.C., become president, and not have people, at least some people around him, who have worked in the White House or have experience in dealing with people in Washington, D.C.? The Democrats have been sitting on the sidelines for 8 years, and many of those people were people who began their political career under the Clintons.
Well, you're exactly right. If you're a Democrat and you're looking around to say who has experience in the executive branch of the federal government, there's only the Clinton team to look to. I mean, the Carter team is, you know, is pretty much aged out at this point.
Right.
So, of course, that's going to be part of it. I think that you have had to have people from Clinton administration in a new team in any case. It is, though, interesting that some of the key people around him, particularly John Podesta and Rahm Emanuel, are such important people from the Clinton White House years, are so identified with President Clinton. And, of course, Hillary Rodham Clinton, that, you know, you would have this discussion no matter what. Because let's remember Barack Obama during the campaign talked about turning a page from the Clinton era. Let's move on. Let's put that in the past. You know, campaigning and governing are different things. And it's one thing to say something out there when you're hustling for votes. It's another thing to actually face the reality of putting together a government, particularly a government at a time when the economy is in such trouble and we've got such important national security threats still overseas.
But why are those things mutually exclusive? I'm lost on that point.
Well, they're not necessarily, but I think that there was a sense of, you know, we're going to change the way Washington does business. We're going to clean out Washington implies we're going to have a fresher group of people. And if it feels like a redux of the last administration, some people are asking about whether they really are going to be people who are change agents. What President-elect Obama is saying is, look, I'm the change agent. I'm getting people who are experienced to help me manage the changes I'm going to be putting in, and look to me for the change you're expecting.
Peter, before we go, just back to the original kind of headline of your article on these memos from the Bush administration, do you think there's a serious sense that we are vulnerable in this transition time, that the timing of these memos and some of this information that you've received relates to some sort of security issue that perhaps they're not being completely candid about?
Well, if they're not, then I don't know. But, I mean, what they say is this is a period of what they call heightened alert because of the nature of the nation's leadership change at the moment, but they don't have any specific imminent threats that they are telling us about, at least. You know, somebody yesterday was very smart about terrorism told me, look, Al-Qaeda doesn't attack on a calendar. They attack when they're ready.
Mm-hmm.
And if they were ready, they would have attacked by now. They wouldn't be waiting. So, you know, it's not that necessarily that terrorists are sitting there looking at our calendar saying, let's try it now. But it is a time when, you know, you have literally one set of folks
right.
putting everything in boxes and another set of folks trying to unpack things and put things in the walls. You know, you're not at your height of capability at that particular moment.
Peter Baker, thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Peter Baker from our partners, the New York Times, talking about the transition from the Bush to Obama administrations and security issues.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age? Everybody has their own opinion. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. Well, because we're a show that either is just extraordinarily annoying or likes to get out in front of things here, particularly before the end of the year. We were taking a look at all the twists and turns of 2008, and it occurred to us, you know, what were the predictions that were made in 2007 that didn't come true? I mean, we've already had a listener say, I predicted Barack Obama would win the presidency. That was a good one. A lot of people got that right. About 60 million people got that right?
Right.
But aside from predicting Barack Obama would win the presidency, what did you get wrong? Or what else did you get right that might have been a lower percentage shot? 877-8-MY-TAKE, mytake at thetakeaway.org. The predictions game is our focus on the takeaway this morning. Again, 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. We've already gotten some great ones. Well, a lot of people realized on last Thursday night, that they suddenly needed a bankruptcy attorney because they were involved in Bernard Madoff's self-described Ponzi scheme. But a lot of people are looking at bankruptcy as an option in this economic environment, whether they're involved in a Ponzi scheme or not. And joining us to talk about the broad issues of bankruptcy in this record economic year is Phil Bentley, who's a bankruptcy litigator with Cramer Levin here in New York City. He's here in the studio with us. Phil, thanks for joining us.
Very welcome.
Let's begin with the Madoff business. There are a lot of people who woke up on Friday morning and realized they hadn't gotten the call, that their investments weren't involved in the Madoff scandal. And there are even some people who maybe were saying to themselves on Friday morning, aren't I a smart guy? I got my money out in time. As the litigation goes forward, as there clearly will be in this Madoff scandal, can people who pulled their money out, say, within the last 4, 5, 6 weeks, be confident that their investments are safe, or is it more complicated than that?
The problem from the perspective of those fortunate enough to get their money out is the losses, of course, were staggering, and
right.
creditors and the bankruptcy trustee are going to be looking for any way to recover money for creditors. And something called the fraudulent conveyance laws that's been applied in bankruptcies a lot gives them the opportunity to go after those who got their money out of the fund.
And the precedent was really established in the Sam Israel case, which was sentenced earlier this year. He was responsible for the so-called Bayou Ponzi scheme. And how does the Sam Israel case relate to the Madoff case in the sense that people who pulled their money out were suddenly vulnerable to having to put it back in and basically give it back to the bankruptcy attorneys because the circumstances of their withdrawal were suspicious in some way?
In the Bayou case, the bankruptcy judge applied this ancient doctrine of fraudulent transfer law. It's a doctrine that goes back to Elizabethan times. And the original case involved a man who transferred his sheep to his wife in order to keep the sheep out of creditors' hands. And nowadays, it's usually applied when somebody's being sued and they transfer their wife to their wife, their house or investments, rather than sheep. In the Bayou case, the judge ruled that investors who were fortunate enough to get out early had to put their money back in for the benefit of creditors if they knew of the fraud, which is straightforward. But here's the problem. He also ruled that if they should have known of the fraud, then they have to put their money back.
And that's what would be precedent setting, because that standard is pretty difficult to prove, that you knew that it was crumbling. And particularly when we look at the Madoff case, this man and his ventures, he was the pillar of credibility for so many decades. So unless there's some kind of paper trail or extensive testimony that individual investors knew that it was about to fall apart, that's a tough one.
The problem is going to be if the bankruptcy court starts looking at who should have known. And that's a debate that can go on endlessly.
Although Christopher Cox of the SEC has said as of yesterday that he should have known. So they're starting to be, maybe not a paper trail, but an evidence trail that might suggest what could have been known in advance.
And the question facing the courts is it fair to penalize those who either were lucky enough to get their money out or who got their money out because they were savvier than most investors and were able to see warning signs that others overlooked, or were diligent enough that they probed beneath the surface and found additional warning signs.
I mean, you're talking about something that could go on endlessly.
This could go on for years and years. And the question is, especially at the present time, when we're in the middle of a financial crisis that was caused by people not picking up on warning signs, Do you really want to create a legal rule that penalizes those who were better than others at picking up on warning signs and doing something about it?
Well, let's look broadly then. I mean, you raise actually a really good point. I mean, there's expected to be a wave of bankruptcies, both in terms of corporate companies that are going under because either lending has dried up, they can't fund their operations, companies that just aren't doing well, period, and they've slipped below the surface. And then individual households are going to be declaring bankruptcy next year. What do you see we might predict it's a boom time for bankruptcy lawyers next year. Is that how you're seeing it?
Unfortunately, that's true. The current times are going to drive a lot of companies into bankruptcy, and we're already seeing that with the Tribune case recently. There's undoubtedly going to be waves of bankruptcies in the retail space, perhaps in the financial sector. This is going to be another bankruptcy boom time.
So what's your advice?
If you're a Madoff investor who was fortunate enough to get your money out, right now I think you need to sit tight and see what's going to happen and hope that you don't get sued. And if you do get sued, I think you need to keep your fingers crossed that the courts will do the right thing.
And in a situation where there are thousands and thousands of people simultaneously in bankruptcy and companies, does it make it more difficult for creditors to recover their money because there's so many ongoing bankruptcy cases if we're talking broadly about the economy?
I don't think that that's a factor. The factor really is, will companies that are in bankruptcy be able to get the sort of financing that they need in order to reorganize and emerge from bankruptcy without liquidating?
And in a credit crunch, that's very, very difficult. Phil Bentley, bankruptcy litigator with the Cramer Levin here in New York City. Thanks for joining us, Phil.
Thank you.
And now headlines from Femi Okeh.
At 28 minutes past the hour, the Commerce Department says the current account trade deficit fell by 3.7% to just over $174 billion in the July to September quarter. On Wall Street, stocks appear headed for a lower open one day after some big gains. Consumers trying to buy a house or finance a car loan could be the big winners as a result of the Fed's decision yesterday to slash its target interest rate. The rate went from 1 to nearly 0, and the Fed says it's ready to take other steps to battle the financial crisis and worsening recession. Iraq's parliament speaker says that he's resigning after legislators argued about the journalist who threw his shoes at President Bush. Iraq's parliament erupted into chaos today as lawmakers argued over whether the journalist should be freed from jail. And as Washington, D.C. prepares for record crowds for Barack Obama's inauguration next month, the D.C. City Council voted last night to allow alcohol to be sold only until 4 a.m. They brought the curfew back from 5 a.m. That's a look at some stories making news this morning.
Thanks, Femi.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org and by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world. Uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering home insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Americans drove more than 100 billion fewer miles between November of 2007 and October of 2008. 100 billion fewer miles than the same period just a year ago.
That's Transportation Secretary Mary Peters this week in New York City. And that decline has many people scratching their heads, wondering if it's a temporary or permanent change in behavior. Florida Congressman John Mackay is hoping it's an opportunity to push through plans for high-speed rail lines in 10 corridors in the U.S. and in turn reduce American dependence on oil and create more efficient modes of transportation. Congressman, why do you think it's so important to talk about a new rail system now?
You know, there's timing for everything, and right now we faced an energy crisis, and while prices have come down, it's not going to go away. We want to do a better job on the environment. And the other thing, too, is just getting around. I mean, the New York area is, and other areas from sea to shining sea are just drowning in congestions, even with fewer people on the road. So in the long term, we've got to have some other solutions than just what we've been doing. And high-speed rail is something the rest of the world's embraced, and the U.S. seems to be falling further behind on.
I should mention that you're the Republican leader of the House Committee on Transportation and Infrastructure, and you have a very specific plan in mind. You want to lay it out for us?
Yeah. What's happened is we've talked about high-speed rail. You know, the Acela, they developed it. It only goes 83 miles an hour on average, actually. I think the governor of New Jersey was clock going faster on the turnpike than that. But what we have found is that we're not building, again, alternative transportation systems. So I came up with the idea, why not have the Department of Transportation, since Amtrak's had a difficult time running an entire national passenger rail system and then getting a bid into faster trains, why not have the Department of Transportation take requests and proposals from the private sector with a public-private partnership approach. And that's what we've just started. The law said in 60 days, and President Bush signed the bill on October 16th, we would take requests for proposals. So that was launched from New York. We did it at Penn Station with Mayor Bloomberg, Mary Peters, and others. Carolyn Maloney from New York was there and other representatives. But that's the day we launched the request for proposals, and we've got 9 months to take them in, and we'll see what the public-private partnerships are offered.
Well, you referred to the Acela there, which, of course, is the Amtrak high-speed mm-hmm. train, which isn't quite so high-speed and has all the problems that Amtrak has. And you noted that there, at least at this, on the surface, appears to be consensus, Republican and Democrat, on some of these initial rail proposals, or at least soliciting proposals to take a look. I'm wondering, since you've talked about the rest of the world here, as you go around the world, what models do you think would work here in the United States of high-speed rail that you've actually experienced personally?
Well, we've seen a number. Of course, you know, some of the European and Asian models are going 150 miles on average, and some are now reaching 200 miles an hour on average, which solves some of your other problems, like the congestion we have rippling from New York's airspace. About 70% of all the delays in the country start in the New York airspace.
So oh, wow. Is that true? Wow.
There are models. They've wiped out just about all the short-distance service in Europe from Brussels to Paris. They've got service, the Thalys, from London to Paris, another route. Almost all the short distance, under 400 miles, 300-400 miles, is now covered by high-speed rail. There are other models, too, for not soaking the taxpayers. And we looked at Richard Branson is quite an entrepreneur. He bought up two of the north-south lines when they were privatizing the UK rail in England. And he's paid a dividend the last 5 years, invested about £5 billion, which is about $10 billion at the
time. You're talking about Richard Branson, who's the founder of Virgin
yes.
Atlantic
and
the airlines.
He has Virgin Rail. The trains look just like the planes, but he's paying a dividend. There's almost no federal subsidy, and dramatic improvements in the quality of both the rail track, and also the vehicles are quite modern.
But that's
it's great stuff. I mean, I want a bullet, as Adora knows, I want a bullet train yeah. in my lifetime. And before we go, we're going to ask you a prediction here.
Get to the prediction, actually, I was just wondering if you could just, in about 3 seconds, how would we pay for that, given that there are a lot of priorities ahead of a railway system?
Well, this won't be subprime or Madoff financing. There's actually revenues that are produced by people getting on these. So that's your first source. And then government's building roads and bridges and other things, and we're going to have to put some government money in it. So we're looking at a public-private partnership.
And we'll see where that goes. But how about a prediction for you quickly?
Bullet train in my lifetime?
In 2009, what do you think?
Hey, if we could build that bridge in Minneapolis in 437 days, we can get this puppy going in no time at all.
Well, there you go. Thank you so much, Florida Congressman John Mica, Republican leader of the House Committee on Transportation and Infrastructure. And he's certainly hoping for a new rail system, or at least a plan for one in 2009. Now we turn to Femi Okeh, who's got headlines.
Thank you very much. At 22 minutes to the top of the hour, Democratic sources say that President-elect Barack Obama has picked former Iowa Governor Tom Vilsack to become his agriculture secretary. Vilsack ran for president early this year. He'll be the fourth former rival to join Team Obama. The announcement is expected to be this morning. Meanwhile, California Representative Javier Becerra says that he's decided not to accept Obama's offer to become the U.S. trade representative. Becerra says that he thinks trade isn't a high enough priority for the incoming administration and that he can do more as a congressman. SEC Chairman Christopher Cox says his agency failed to follow through properly on allegations against Bernard Madoff, the man at the center of an alleged $50 billion scam. Cox says that he's gravely concerned about the failures. And Richard Lindsay, former director of market regulation for the SEC, has come to the SEC's defense, suggesting that the staff is very small, considering the large number of securities being traded on the markets.
The enforcement staff is something around the order of 1,000 people. That's about the size of a legal department at a single large financial institution.
SEC Chairman Christopher Cox has ordered an investigation into the Madoff scam. The Fed's decision to cut interest rates to their lowest level on record is good news for banks and consumers. The cut is expected to lead to lower rates on existing adjustable-rate home equity loans, and a new boom in refinancing is expected. And finally, President Bush is expected to trumpet his war record when he speaks today at the U.S. Army War College in Pennsylvania. The White House says that the president intends to remind the country that the war on terror will continue long after his presidency. And that's a look at stories making news this morning.
Thanks, Femi.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
Good morning. This is The Takeaway. I'm Adora Udoji.
And I'm John Huckenberry. And it's as though the markets around the world are gorged with news of all kinds, good news, bad news, record interest rates going down, going up. Markets have opened this morning on Wall Street, and they're sort of stalled. The Dow opened significantly lower, over 1%, and now is bouncing around at about a little under 1% down. The question is, with low volumes and a sense of where do we go from here being less clear than ever before, the markets seem to be responding with a big yawn to the news yesterday that the Fed has reduced its key interest rate to between 0 and 0.25%. Joining us now to discuss the market's reaction to all of this is Gretchen Morgenson, assistant business and financial editor and a columnist at the New York Times. Gretchen, thanks for coming back to the program.
Sure, John. How are you?
Fine. The volumes are kind of low. It's an end-of-year sort of gray moment for the markets. It seems as though the markets really don't know what to do with the Fed announcement yesterday.
Well, of course, yesterday they were up big on the announcement itself. But, you know, what I think happens often is that a lot of traders sort of act first and think later. In this case, I think what the markets are telling you this morning in their sort of doldrums reaction is that the question is the Fed's move to drop interest rates to these unprecedented levels or almost unprecedented levels going to do any good? I mean, it really is all about getting the wheels of commerce moving through the lending by major banks. And while the Fed can encourage banks to lend by dropping rates and making the bank's spread or earnings, you know, higher based on the interest rates that they charge their customers, they really can't force them to lend. And we know, I think a lot of us out there, consumers and businesses, understand that credit is tighter and lending is not going on. So the Fed can drop rates all they want. If the banks don't Portland, it really isn't going to get the economy moving again.
Well, we spoke with a former Fed official yesterday who said that the Fed's other levers are going to be tried now, which include buying assets to try to boost lending in other sorts of ways. Maybe the Fed is actually signaling stop paying attention to interest rates and the market is responding in some way.
Well, I think that that's a good idea to buy some of those securities to sort of liquefy the banks. But I also think that there is a worry, of course, that all of these actions are going to have a consequence further down the line, whether it be, you know, a depreciation of the dollar, because obviously the more dollars that are out in the system, the less value those dollars carry. You know, this is obviously a problem that we are trying to deal with on the short term, immediate, to get banks lending, to get commerce going again, but also it will have really brutal consequences longer term down the road. And so is the Fed, you know, aware, and will they, you know, sort of bring back in this easy money attitude when they need to prevent inflation from coming back?
Is there a clock ticking on that? If we don't get the stimulus, will the dollar fall precipitously early next year? And we just have a few seconds, Gretchen.
Well, I think the dollar is already falling because the rates have dropped so low. And so, you know, you've got that problem. So it is possible entirely that it will continue.
Clock ticking and markets still not clear on direction. Gretchen Morgenson, assistant business and financial editor and columnist for The New York Times. Thanks for joining us.
Anytime, John.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to, available at responsibilityproject.com. Because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. It's Wednesday, December 17th, and Femi Oke has just joined us with the latest headlines.
And the time is just coming up to 12 minutes to the top of the hour. Iraq's parliament speaker says that he's resigning. The parliament erupted into chaos today as lawmakers argued over whether the journalist who threw his shoes at President Bush should be freed from jail. Chaos reigned elsewhere in the capital as well. At least 18 people have been killed and dozens more wounded in a double bombing in eastern Baghdad. Iraqi police says that the first blast came from a car bomb and then a roadside bomb exploded moments later as people rushed to help. Prime Minister Gordon Brown says that British troops will be fully out of Iraq by the end of July 2009. He made the announcement today during a surprise visit to Baghdad. Two trains have collided just before dawn in southeastern Minnesota, causing some of the cars to fall into the Mississippi River. It caused a propane leak at a switching station, which has forced an evacuation of the area surrounding the crash. And so far as we know, two people have gone to hospital. Top executives at GM and Chrysler are still waiting to hear what financial rescue plan the government has in store for them. White House Press Secretary Dana Perino says that the Bush administration is still considering the best way to help out U.S. automakers.
We are moving with all deliberate speed in order to try to do this in an orderly fashion. But we're not going to be rushed into it just because there is pressure from the media or others coming through you on us to do something rash.
GM and Chrysler say they need billions of dollars in bridge loans to keep them out of bankruptcy. And finally, Adora, a story for you. 60% of pet owners say that when they speak, their pets actually understand them.
Absolutely.
Okay, so you're amongst the 60%.
My two Norwich Terriers, they know exactly what I'm saying.
10% of pet owners say they have no clue what they're saying or their pet's saying back to them.
We should book them. Help us out.
The dogs?
Yeah.
I'd love to have the dogs on.
They would. Trust me. They talk. They have expressed, they have very strong opinions about things.
Well, and again, we are trying to book them, and we'll see. Maybe on later on in the program. Yesterday in Italy, I don't know if you saw this, Femi, you reported on this yesterday, 1,200 anti-mafia police fanned out across the country and they made 94 arrests of alleged members of the Sicilian mafia known as the Cosa Nostra.
Right.
All kinds of charges. According to reports, they were preemptively trying to prevent the organization from forming a new board of directors. So to get more about this story, we spoke with BBC correspondent Duncan Kennedy, who joined us earlier from London.
Hi, John.
This is, an amazingly interesting raid. It's codenamed Operation Perseus, and it relates to the Greek hero who beheaded Medusa. Medusa, of course, being a metaphor for the Cosa Nostra here. First of all, is this raid perceived as successful, and why was it timed this way?
Certainly being perceived as successful. In the words of one minister here, it was unprecedented, and I think that is the case. Speaking to various experts on the mafia here, they can't remember an operation of this size for some years. Timing-wise, interesting. The Cosa Nostra, the Sicilian mafia, have been on the back foot for some years. And I think this was really a time when they thought maybe they're trying to re-emerge again and form this commission you spoke of there, this board of directors, otherwise known as the cupola, which really sets strategies and organises policies. And I think they thought it was trying to be reconstructed. They were trying to get new leadership for it. And now was the time to strike. And strike they did.
Speaking of timing again, what is it about the current environment that might suggest to investigators that the Cosa Nostra is resurgent? What businesses are they getting involved in? And what sorts of ventures are working out for them?
It's the usual suspects. The 90 or so men involved, some of these guys into their 60s and 70s, been at this a long time, allegedly. Things like extortion, drug trafficking, arms trafficking. It is the usual suspects. It is also the kind of thing they're trying to do on Sicily, a lot of trying to extort money out of businesses and individuals. Again, in the words of these experts, you really can't operate in places like Sicily and also on the mainland, in places like Naples and southern Italy, where other branches of the mafia operate, without mafia coercion and permission to get your life going. They are very pernicious. They are very widespread in the southern part of Italy. As I say, in Sicily, there was a perception that somehow the Cosa Nostra were not the force they once were, but they were still a dangerous, violent force that never quite went away. And this was another operation, one of many, to keep them on the back foot. No one here saying the Cosa Nostra are a finished force, are a spent force, but this operation really has dealt them another serious blow.
And you were speaking with us, I believe it was, just a few weeks back, that the liquidity crisis and the credit crunch has had an impact on at least consumers or certain individuals who are in dire need of money there in Italy, because they were going to alleged members of the mafia to get money because no banks were lending to them. Is it possible that they're benefiting from this?
Mafia Inc., as the saying
went. Right.
Yeah, I mean, that is exactly the case. That now accounts for, according to this report that we were quoting a couple of weeks ago, for something like $15 billion worth of their annual turnover these days. Again, not just the Cosa Nostra. It involves the Camorra, which is based around the city of Naples, and the 'Ndrangheta, which is further south in Italy. These are really the two main organisations on the mainland now. And yes, very much so. This amazing figure of 180,000 small businesses were turning to the mafia, legitimate businesses, it has to be said, were turning to the mafia because credit funds from banks were drying up as the worldwide recession takes hold. And these businesses, the ones we spoke to, were saying they had no choice. They had to turn to these organisations because that's the only source of liquidity, the only source of funds. And no doubt that is continuing, and no doubt one of the more reasons why the police felt it was time to act to try and break up these rackets that the mafia in all parts, whether it's in Sicily or the mainland, are so very much into at the moment.
Hey, Duncan, what's the Italian track record on prosecutions? I remember last go around, Berlusconi's government, along with the local prosecutors, went after suspected mafia leaders and soldiers maybe 4 or 5 years ago. Now, did any of them end up in prison, and where did they end up in prison for some significant amount of time?
Yes, there are successful prosecutions, Adora. There are. I mean, we did a story quite recently about overcrowding in jails, particularly in Sicily, and where there are a number of extremely dangerous and sinister and violent mafiosi being held. Others do escape the net. There's no doubt about it. The perceived head, or the man trying to be the head of this new commission, is still at large, which is part of the reason why the operation took place yesterday. There is still one man at large. They still want to get their hands on him. But yes, there are successful prosecutions, though it is sometimes difficult getting people to talk. They are deeply afraid of all these mafia gangs.
So I can't resist, Duncan, but you've looked at the papers this morning, right?
Go on.
There must be some fabulous headlines describing what happened yesterday.
They have, but I don't have them to hand. I'm sure they are. It was not a celebratory feel right to this. There was a sense that it's a long time coming. The government has promised, the government of Silvio Berlusconi has promised to take on organised crime. There hadn't been much evidence of it since he came to office back in March, April. I think this is one of those kind of actions. Not only was it justified in policing terms, but also politically the government has been under pressure to take the fight to the mafia, in this case the Cosa Nostra. And yes, there are headlines, banner headlines, as I said, because of the unprecedented scale of this operation. But it's not a kind of the tone on the television news has not been one of celebration. It's been one of a long time coming, if I can put it like that. The mafia appear to be getting a stronghold again, appear to be taking a foothold in some of the places where they've been traditionally strong. And it was time some action was taken. And yes, the government has acted very forcefully.
All right, Duncan, before we go, this person who's still at large, can you give us a name and tell us a little bit about him?
I could give you a name. Again, I don't have that to hand. He was trying to fill the boots of a man called Bernardo Provenzano. He was the guy who was the head of this commission. And there were one or two rivals trying to vie for the position of being the boss of bosses, take over his position. He himself was arrested. He was trying to muscle in and do what he did a couple of years ago until his arrest, and that is run the mafia's operations on Sicily. One man was captured. Another man is still at large. And I dare say the police will be looking for him in the mop-up operations that are still taking place on Sicily today.
Man, I really put Duncan Kennedy on the spot there. He's the BBC Rome correspondent, and he joined us, not from London, but from Rome.
And we put some listeners on the spot. We were asking about your predictions, either for 2008 or for 2009.
Hi, my name is Paul. I'm calling from Milford, Connecticut. I predicted that New York was recession-proof, that Wall Street would always be making money. And lo and behold, New York is as susceptible as everywhere else.
That's one that sadly many people wish that he had predicted correctly. And that was for 2008, but how about 2009?
My prediction is that Barack Obama will have an incredibly popular beginning, that will come out of this tailspin, economic tailspin, by the summer of 2009. But then he will have some trouble in Afghanistan in the fall of 2009 as we get bogged down like we did in Iraq.
Well, that was real specific. What are your predictions for 2009, and what were you right or wrong about in 2008? 8778 my take or my take at thetakeaway.org.
We are always on. If you miss anything, of course, you can take our podcast to go, and you can subscribe right now at thetakeaway.org or on iTunes. I'm John Hockenberry.
I'm Adora Udoji, and this is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. The Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org. And by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway.